No, I'm assuming that I know it's a normal distribution. And my guess is of something like IQ, they probably construct the test to give you a normal distribution. And if I know it's a normal distribution, then that tells me how what percentage of it is within any given distance of the mean, and you can just look that up in the z-table. So the z-table will basically say, for z greater than 3.1, 0.001 of the distribution will be that high or higher, that kind of result. All right, so let me dump this, put in the one that's supposed to be there, which is this, which I just updated half an hour ago or so. And now we do this one and take it to the relevant place. Just did that. This normal distribution. And now we get to the next thing we're supposed to be doing. And this is a distinction that you want to make between what's referred to as the sample statistic and the population statistic. So, for example, suppose what we want to know is the average height of students at Santa Clara University Law School. And that's a mean of a whole population, however many hundred students we have. One way of estimating it would be to ask the five of you what your heights are, take that average. That would be a sample statistic. That would be the average for those five people, not the average for the whole population, but it would be one way of estimating the average of the population, since you're the ones we have available to ask questions of. Can you think of ways in which that would be a biased sample? What's the obvious way in which it would be a biased sample? You're all male, correct. You're all male. And I assume about half our students are female, and on average women are shorter than men. So
that's Santa Clara is 52% female is one of the critical factors that chosen.
You're saying that's the reason that you came here? Yeah. You couldn't find one that was 55%.
No, you could. Maybe over at Rollins. They didn't have a law school.
I was told by a colleague not in the law school that Vassar has got to have a majority of women. That its bylaws require that. It used to be a woman's school, apparently when they changed. So some people might consider that an asset. The warm water. That actually is. How about suppose we wanted to know not the mean for heights, but the standard deviation. So we wanted to say for the students in the law school, what's a measure of how much their heights vary? Again, we could take five of you and we could calculate the standard deviation for your heights. But in fact, in that case, there's a further problem. And the easiest way to illustrate the problem is to imagine that we have a sample size of one. So suppose we have a really small sample and we pick one of us at random and we say, what's your height? And we say the height. And we say, well, that gives us an estimate of the average height of students. It's a very bad estimate, but it gives us some information on it after all. Now we say, what's the standard deviation of the heights of this sample? How much do they? Zero. Right? Does it follow that the standard deviation? No, that's no. It tells us nothing at all about the standard deviation. And if you think about it, one way of putting it is that that's the striking case for one, but it's also true for five, that if I took five people, the standard deviation of those five on average would be smaller than the standard deviation for the population. And the reason is that if the five all happen to be tall, then their mean is also tall, and so their deviation for their mean is small. If the five all happen to be short, then that pushes the mean in their direction. So we're looking at standard deviation as the distance from the mean, and whatever the bias in the population, the mean is going to have the same bias, and that'll make it look as though they are closer to the mean than they really are. So it turns out that the rule of thumb for dealing with this, I think the correct statistical rule, is that instead of calculating the standard deviation by taking all of the deviations, squaring them, summing them, and dividing by the number, the way you normally take an average, then square root of that, you divide by n minus 1. So that there are five of you. I take the mean of your heights. I take, for each of you, your height minus the mean. I square that. I add them, but I then divide that number by 4, not by 5. And that turns out to be the right way of compensating for the fact
that... Yeah, I never really could understand the background behind that logic necessarily, yep. But it makes sense when numbers come up.
Yep. Yes. Well, you shouldn't understand it, and I certainly haven't proved it. I'm trying to make it seem plausible, not to prove it. I probably couldn't prove it. Well, I could probably understand the proof if I'd read it somewhere. But in any case, the basic point I'm making is that what you normally have as a sample statistic, you're trying to use it to estimate a population statistic. That's a useful way of thinking of things. All right, so let me just... I'm not going to actually read this. You can read it through. This is basically just a summary of what we've just done. Except for the last bit, which we haven't done. We'll do that a little bit later. Oopsie. I thought I had added to this, but maybe I didn't. Just one more moment. Let me look at the beginning, because I had come across a real case I wanted to discuss with you, and I thought I had put it in here somewhere, and I'm now not seeing it. If I don't see it, I'll tell it to you instead. Because it was a here we are. Yes. All right, it's just in the wrong place. So, news story, that for 2008, auto death rates per capita were at a record low, 9% below the rate for the previous year. So you can read it, I'm not going to read that aloud. But that was from an article that reported this information, this is what they said it meant. You'll notice that quote is...
that final portion, is there a connection to impaired driving and teen driving?
What do you mean?
What?
They have no data on that. That
okay.
Is, this is some...
Which
the only impaired. Fact the only fact we have is that the death rates went down.
Correct.
This quote is what somebody says is the reason. And obviously you can imagine a variety of reasons. If you were... somebody in the business of public education of safety, you would want to say, of course, it's public education of safety that did it. If you were supporting laws making seatbelt wearing compulsory, you would want to say that was what did it, and so forth.
Okay,
and so that raises the question for us, how would you figure out, if you'd given this, what guesses might you make about possible reasons, and what additional information might you want to look at? And you could imagine... Among the possible reasons are, should you support the various policies that these people say caused it? Alternatively, suppose there's, I don't know what the regulation on insurance companies is, but I'm sure there are regulations on what insurance companies do. And suppose somebody says, look, the insurance company should be forced to cut their rates because we've just observed that the chance of auto accidents has dropped 9%, and so they should be cutting their rates 9%. You might be an attorney either for the insurance companies or for the regulators. Arguing either side of that. You can think of a variety of cases where some issue a lawyer would care about would hinge on the reason for this. And so then the question is, how would you look at this? It's a real case. What guesses might you make about other possible reasons that you might... Yes?
During the summer when most driving takes place, gas was $5, and so people...
Very good. So the first guess that might occur to you is that 2008 had very expensive gasoline. Very expensive gasoline results in less driving, and you will notice that these are death rates per capita. So how would you? What piece of information would you want to look at in order to answer that question?
Maybe like deaths per hour of driving.
How about per mile of driving, which is more readily available? Yes. Turns out the deaths per mile of driving declined only 4%. So just over half of the change apparently reflected less driving. So that was a good guess. So we're now down to 4%. What's the next question you might want to ask?
Could this also imply that just emergency services were better?
That could be a possible explanation. So for how would you check on whether it was the improvement, whether it was the reduction in death rates rather than accidents was the obvious thing to look at?
I mean, which is the actual number then?
Number of what?
The accidents and then also...
accidents. Right.
The time of response to 2 years.
Yeah, that's why it's going to be hard to find. But you could at least look at accident rates figures. And if it turned out that the accident rate didn't go down, then that would at least strongly hint at the conjecture you're offering that we got better at saving lives for some reason. What else?
How safe cars are going to be long term.
How safe cars are.
But
notice what's the reason why it's very unlikely that safer cars by themselves are responsible for a large drop between 2007 and 2008. That's right, because the cars in any given time are the average over the last whatever 10 years or so, not the current one. So but suppose you thought it was safer cars. What now would be the obvious number to look for, or the obvious fact to look for, if you could? Somebody says that some new safety requirements. Sure. Suppose someone says what's going on is that there were some new safety requirements that were passed in 2007, and all the cars built from the mid 2007 to 2008 or something had airbags or something. So now, what would be the obvious?
There would be two types of safety. One would be maybe like better brakes, which would prevent accidents from happening in the first place. The other would be better airbags.
Sure. So you could look for
the latter. You could look at accident rate.
But how would we figure out whether it was the changes that came in a particular model year of cars that did it?
Because it saves a future type of injury.
You're being too fancy. Much simpler, isn't it?
Well, you could just look at how many cars were sold.
But surely what you really want to do is to look at accident rates by model year of car. If you observed the death rates of people driving 2008 cars were a lot lower than driving 2006 cars, then that becomes plausible. That wouldn't be sure, though, because it might be that people who drive new cars are, for some reason, more careful drivers or are less likely to be... You can think of a variety of possible other explanations. But one way to check that would be to say, all right, let's look back a couple of years. Were the accident rates of people driving in 2007 of people driving 2006 cars much lower than those people driving 2004 cars? And that would be a way of telling whether there was some standard difference between new cars and older car drivers that was responsible. But it seems to me that you're all missing what would seem to me to be one of the first things to look at. And that is whether there's an existing trend.
Right. Does that happen every year anyway?
Suppose it turned out when you looked at the data that on average, deaths per mile have been falling at 4% a year. All right? And this looks striking because that's being combined with the reduction in driving that gave you the big drop in deaths per capita. But if they've been falling at 4% a year forever, roughly, with some random fluctuation of some sort, then the fact they fell 4% this year, could be a result of gradual improvements in the quality of cars, in the quality of medicine. You can think of a lot of things. And in fact, I don't know, I haven't looked to see what the situation is here, but it is the case that highway death rates trend down. At least they did when I knew the figures a long time ago. And I think a lot of that is the combination of better medical service and somewhat better built cars. Let's try one other thing. Suppose we eliminated all of these possibilities. One other thing you might want to look at is how 2007 compared with previous years. Because after all, it could be that what's going on is not that 2008 was extraordinarily safe, but 2007, for some reason, was extraordinarily dangerous. In which case, the drop from 2007 would look like a sign of something that just happened, whereas it was actually, you would then want to know why 2007 was high. So the basic point I'm really suggesting is that in making sense of facts like this, it's not enough to just say, well, here's the fact, it dropped 9%. You want to think about what are all of the other kinds of information that can help you to figure out why it happened. And that could be trends, it could be accident rates by model year of car, it could be change in how much driving people were doing, and so forth. So all of those, just since it was a real news story I actually came across, I thought it was a nice way of showing why facts don't speak for themselves and why you need statistics of one sort or another to analyze them. All right. So we've just run through all of them. And if you take the implications. If what's happening is that 2007 was unusually dangerous, then that's not an argument for why the insurance rates should be lower, right? The insurance companies lost the money in 2007. If there's a long-term trend down, then you would expect insurance rates to have a long-term trend down. If the reason is people drove less, well, unless you expect gas to be expensive next year as well, that's no reason why insurance rates should be lower, and so forth. All right, I just went through this stuff already. Let me now make a broader point about what one does with statistics, because two different things that one often does. One of them is testing a hypothesis. So somebody has some claim, and you can read the list of ones I have there, and you can see how any of these might be issues people would care about. So that concealed carry, if you're not familiar with it, the question is whether ordinary people should be allowed to carry a concealed handgun. And there are many states in which they are, in which they, I think there are almost always some legal requirements, but there are states in which an ordinary citizen who's never been convicted of a felony, basically, and hasn't been committed to an insane asylum, can, you know, fill out the relevant forms and get permission to carry a concealed handgun. There are other states where the only people who are allowed to, cities really, where in effect the only people who are allowed to own handguns de facto, though not de jure, are if you're either an alderman's bodyguard or a bank guard, or a policeman, of course, because you need a permit. They don't issue permits. And there's everything in between. And there's been a long and very heated argument, in part among statisticians, on whether in fact legal life and concealed carry reduces crime. Since an ex-student of mine was at the center of it, I was following it for a while, although I have not followed the recent years of it. But here you have a hypothesis. The hypothesis is legalizing concealed carry reduces crime, or reduces certain kinds of crime. And the argument, of course, is that you're less likely to mug someone if you're afraid he might shoot you if you do. And similarly, there's a long-standing argument about whether capital punishment deters. And you can easily enough imagine being in a discrimination lawsuit where the question is, the hypothesis is this firm discriminates against women, and so forth for the other couple. And if we were thinking about ways of changing the law school's curriculum, we might like to ask whether certain changes did or didn't increase the bar passage rate. So one of the things you use statistics for is to try to answer these questions. And you essentially never answer them with certainty. You never say, yes, we know for certain that capital punishment deters, but you might say, this is pretty strong evidence that it does, or pretty strong evidence that it doesn't, or things of that sort. A different use of statistics is for estimating the characteristics of a population. So suppose that you are working for an insurance company and you're starting some new kind of insurance, that you've decided that students should be insured against flunking out, or that law students should be insured against not passing the bar. All right, that seems like an obvious possibility. Presumably, I was talking to students in the other class, and you know, that's the nightmare, as it were, that you go through all of this and don't pass the bar, so maybe you should, for a suitable price, be able to buy insurance that will pay for your spending, you know, a year in Hawaii to get over the shock of not passing the bar. And if you're the insurance company that's doing it, what you want is an estimate of, for the population of law students who will buy our insurance, how many of them will not pass the bar, so that we know what price to charge in order that we can cover our costs and make some money. So that's a case where you're estimating a characteristic of a population from whatever data you've got available. Similarly, if you wanted to predict the last presidential election, maybe in order to bet on it or something, or in order to decide which candidate you should give money to on the grounds they might remember it later, you would like to estimate of all of the voters how many will vote for each person, and so forth, for lots and lots of other questions. And when you're estimating characteristics of a population, you usually want not just the mean, but various other things. It depends what you're doing, but in many cases. And you also want to know not just what do I think the mean is, but how sure am I that I'm right. So that if you imagine the insurance case and you tell your boss, I've figured out that 1 in 5 is going to fail to pass the bar. And he says, well, sounds as though we can charge him $1,000 for $5,000 worth of insurance. And by the way, how sure are you that it's 1 in 5? You say, well, I don't have very much data, actually. It might be 2 in 5, but of course it might be only 1 in 10. Well, maybe we better not start this program yet because we could lose a lot of money. So you'd like to know not just what your best estimate is, but how confident you are of that estimate. And those are the sorts of things. So in effect, you can use statistics to do both of these things. I just went through that. So sources of error in statistics. One source is just random sampling error, the fact that pick the 6 of you, might happen that, you know, you're all unusually tall. In fact, you obviously are all unusually tall. After all, you're all taller than I am.
At least at the average.
Yeah. Well, you're all taller than I am, right? So you're obviously all taller. 5'3.5".
Oh, no way.
So I think I can guarantee that you're all taller than I am. But anyway, but just random selection. My point is that random selection could give you sampling error. And how do you think you generally try to reduce sampling error when you've just got a random sample? What's the obvious way of doing it? How do I, if I wanted to estimate the average height of Santa Clara University students after deciding that just taking the 6 of you isn't a great idea, what would be a better way of getting a more accurate estimate?
Increase the
sample size, exactly. To look at 50 people instead of 6 people, and then random chance isn't going to have as large an effect. What?
You can use the t-distribution fat and tails if you want.
You can.
How do you fat and tails for the t-distribution?
It's just you enter the number of samples in, and that's it, and it starts to become homeless.
But you're just saying that a larger number.
Yeah, you just change your curve or whatever.
A larger number will get. But the second problem, the first one is just random sample error. But the second problem is the question of was it random? So that if you think about this one, if we ask for ages, what are the two things that are going to make this a non-random sample of age for Santa Clara University students? In opposite directions, as it turns out.
It's not a night class.
Very good. It's not a night class. And I expect part-time students are older on average than regular students, and part-time students are likely to be in night classes. And what's the effect in the other direction?
Not first year.
You're not first years. That's right. This is a class which is taken by second and third year students. So in that, this particular sample, therefore, is biased in two respects, which happen to go in opposite directions. I don't know how big either of them is. So do you know the story about the poll that showed that Dewey was going to beat Truman? 1940. Wait a minute. Did Roosevelt die before or after 44? Is this 44 or 48?
He died in the right
after.
Right. So he died in
44. So he got elected.
He got elected.
And so I guess it's the 48 election that was Truman against Dewey. I think that's right, because 52 is Eisenhower. So 1948, they do a telephone poll, and they conclude Dewey is going to win. And supposedly some major newspaper prints up, you know, Dewey wins, and then they have to recall a whole bunch. So what was the mistake? Why did they get the wrong answer? Not just not that many. Who owned telephones? Right. The owners of telephones were biased towards higher income. And at least in that election, the higher income people were more likely to vote Republican, consequently. So that's an example, just like the ones we're giving, of things you've got to watch for in looking at your data. And notice that all of these things you really are looking at it with two different heads on, as it were. One of them is, if I want to find out what's true, what mistakes do I avoid making? And the other is, if someone else is trying to persuade me that something is true, what mistakes might he be deliberately making? All right, so if you imagine that you're in litigation and somebody gives you figures, one of the things you want to say is, how could he have biased the sample? And you know which direction he'll bias the sample in, whichever direction he wants the results to go in. Third problem, so we've got sampling error and bias. Third problem is validity, meaning is the information I've gotten actually true? So any of you ever lie about your age?
You know, occasionally I would say over 18.
When you weren't?
No, not at all. It wasn't a lie, in other words. It was an accidental misleading, because I knew the question was, are you a minor or not? And I'm like, over 18.
And people might assume that meant you were 18 or 19 when you were really 20.
They'd assume I was 25 at that point. Something different. Yep. Not 18 exactly. When I say over 18, that means
yes,
I can buy this pack of cigarettes.
Right.
That's what your question, that's your purpose. Don't ask me my exact age. Yep. Ask me what your purpose is.
Yeah. But so that would be but in fact there's a further.
I wouldn't call that a lie necessarily, it was accidental.
But that also illustrates a reason why people might in fact deliberately lie, because they wanted to buy cigarettes.
Yes.
So if you were asking what are the ages of our patrons, and if you weren't insisting on ID,
if you weren't taking some random sample or something.
If you said people going out of this checkout lane, and we're going to check their age, you wonder how old our patrons are. And it turns out this checkout lane is where the cigarettes are, and so a lot of people who want to buy cigarettes go out that. You might discover that some of the 16-year-olds were claiming to be 18 and some of the 17-year-olds. So that would be a case. And you can think of, I mean, I'm running through a couple of other examples on the screen. You can read them for yourself, but those are all cases.
You know, I also have, this is an interesting story. Let me take a break for now.
Yep.
I have a friend who is really cool, and it's a female. You know, it's really nice to throw females in here right now. But she's really cool, and I think she happens to be over 30 years old, and her and her sister had made a pact. They said once they get above 30 years old, their age from then on out is 33 plus. So at that point, from 30, they said they were 33 plus. 31, 33 plus, 33, 33 plus. So people are like, you know, they're not exaggerating. They're actually telling people we're older. And that's really weird for a woman to do it naturally for society. Then all of a sudden they get 35, and you're like, 33 plus. And as long as they don't, their body hasn't aged as much as they used to, then it works out cleanly.
This is reminding me of the story of the two women, two sisters, and one of them said, you know, I've decided I'm not going to marry till I'm 25.
Right.
And the other one said, I've decided I'm not going to be 25 till I get married. So again, note my final point that both bias and invalidity could be either accidental or deliberate, depending on whether somebody is trying to get particular results. So again, the parameter you're trying to estimate is the average height of all SCU students. The average of U6 is a statistic, population statistic, sample statistic, and we're using that to try to estimate the parameter. Here are some examples, and you can tell me what's wrong with estimating the support for a bill in Congress by the congressman looking at his constituents' letters and say how many are in favor and how many against. What?
You get the exchange, people are willing to sit down and you get interested parties or something like that.
That you're likely to get not a random sample, but people who care enough to go to the trouble of writing a letter, and depending on the particular issue, it might be an issue which most people are against a little bit and a few are enthusiastic before, or the other way around. And it also might be an issue where the people who supported the bill got up a letter writing campaign, and there is no comparable organization the other way. How about we ask students in a class on international trade how important is to them, to their future, how many opportunities they have to travel? It's pretty obvious. How about the jury pool problem? We want to figure out what the pool of people is available to select for a jury.
That's a tough sample there, because you're taking the unemployed as opposed to the employed.
The unemployed, both in the sense
home,
of...
Or home office,
or housewives.
Right.
I
would say discriminatory on some level.
It's only, whether it's discriminatory or not, it's going to be a bad sample.
I'm saying the sample is not that same.
That's right. Yeah. That is the... How about if you estimate the percentage of rotten apples by looking at the ones at the top of the crate? What are the problems with that? What? One, there are actually two entirely different problems. One of them is there may be mechanical reasons why it's higher or lower. That is, you could imagine yours, that the ones in the on the top get sun damaged. Or you can imagine the other way around, that the ones deep down have the pressure of the other apples on top of them, and it's moisture because the water... So you could think of various reasons. What's the other reason why you shouldn't do it that way? Suppose that... The person who arranges them and wants to sell these apples to you is going to make sure the prettiest ones are on the top. Exactly. Right. How about any guess... what Ron Paul's votes would have been if we had believed online polls?
25%?
Something like that. It was very, very high. And what are the two things that are going on here?
All his supporters were...
That is, one of them is that libertarians are much more common on the internet than the population as a whole. They're still a minority, but they're a much larger minority. And the second is that a candidate like Ron Paul, where people who like him are a small number of enthusiasts, they're the ones who are going to go to the effort of going up and voting maybe once or twice or three or five or 10 times for him on online polls if they can manage to do it. That's right. So how do we control for bias?
Adding factors, adding samples.
That is by
the sample.
Increasing the sample if you can do it, but you can also weight the sample. You can also say that we know the students take height. So not the example here, but suppose we want the average height of the students, and suppose we've done our sampling in several classes, and it turned out that those classes were 3/4 men and 1/4 women. I don't know why, but I assume some classes women take more and some men take more. And one of the things you could do is to say, all right, since we know the real population is about 50-50, let each of the women count as 3, each of the men count as 1. That gets us 3/4 and 3/4, equal numbers. So we're now, in effect, calculating the average height of women, the average height of men, and then averaging those two together, rather than the average height of a population that's mostly men. Make sense? And you can think of various other ways in which you could do it. I give an example for part-time students the same way. Can you think of any problems with doing that?
Weighting certain students' responses. Right. So one part-time student may not be the same as the other part-time student's opinions, but you're counting them for 5 people.
So a different way of putting it is that you've increased your sample error, in effect, because...
Is that an intensity intensity rating? Like
how much of an error your sample...
What I'm saying is that if you pick 50 people, there's random variation. There's a lot more random variation if you pick 5 people. But if you pick 5 people and multiply them by 10, you're getting a whole lot more random variation than if you pick 50 people. So you've got that, the potential for, I mean, again, take my Ron Paul example. If it turned out that one or two of your part-time students were Ron Paul enthusiasts, you would end up with a big overestimate, I think, of the number of supporters of his in the class, because of the fact that each of those is counting for 5 in this particular weighted average. So... On average, you wouldn't get more for Ron Paul or fewer, but you'd get a bigger swing, as it were, due to that. Then sampling validity is a sort of familiar point which people who are doing polls with malice aforethought all know about, which is that you can phrase your question in a way that gives the result. So... One of them is people lying, of course, but one of them also should be let anyone who wants to carry a concealed handgun, or should we let people carry concealed handguns to protect themselves from criminals? Which one do you think will get a higher percentage response?
Second.
Suppose you really were against concealed handguns and you wanted to get a really low response. Can you think of ways of phrasing a question that would be more effective?
We don't want
Suppose you're anti-concealed handgun. How would you phrase the question in order to get the result that most people were against it?
The point that you just said, well, even though people, concealed handguns for even those who are impoverished, they're like marginally, very like reduced intellect, or like you can always like change the.
Yes, that's put it in terms of should. Should ordinary people, even if they had no special training or demonstrated no evidence of responsibility, be allowed to carry concealed handguns? Something like that. Yeah, that probably wouldn't. But you want to put it in some form which makes them think about the downside of the proposal, whereas protecting themselves from criminals makes them think about the upside of the proposal. So, do you support Bill Clinton's wife for president? I would guess fewer people than do you support Senator Clinton for president. The Harvard questionnaire, I think I actually have here, and you presumably have all had a chance to look at it since it was on the syllabus. Comments on this particular one? I assume it's Harvard only in the sense the people who wrote the book were at Harvard, and so they may have actually given it or used it in the course at Harvard. Let me bring it up. Yeah. So what's your guess about the biases that you would get from these questions? These are... at the end, evaluate it. Which questions here are likely to give accurate? Do you think that's going to give reasonably accurate?
No, that would be biased.
Because?
It's assuming that you're religious at all. Is that what you're saying?
Well, not at
all.
You could, although not at all is one possible answer. How many people are going to say they're extremely religious?
You know, that was an interesting question because I actually thought about that. I was like, you know, and I didn't even think about it in the context of sample errors or
yep.
any level
yep.
whatsoever. It's just like, you know, why would, if anything, people will say not at all, moderately, or very, or like extremely, right away you get like a red flag. And just
that's
like,
right.
You know, I wouldn't even say it. Even
and in a sense, the very and extremely are really covering the same thing twice and therefore splitting the... the group, yeah. I don't
extremely
know.
Extremely almost means like I'm the priest.
Yeah. Well, it was before any of you. It was before any of you were born. But in the 1964 presidential election, the term extremist was being used, sort of like terrorist or socialist. It was being used.
I needed the word fundamental first.
Fundamentalist gets used that way nowadays too. But extremist. So there was a famous. A famous.
I didn't notice it down in question six, though. It's interesting.
Yes, there was a famous line by Barry Goldwater, which he was then attacked for. It was actually probably written by Carl Hess, who was writing some of his speeches, which was extremism in the defense of freedom is no vice. Moderation in the pursuit of liberty is no virtue. And of course, he was right. But at the same point, if you think of extremism as having a meaning by itself, rather than being extremely something, it sounds, you know, terrorism in the pursuit of liberty is a good thing. So we got a good deal of tax for that. So, yeah, I think the extremely one is very poorly put. How about how often do you attend religious services outside your home? What's going to happen on that one, do you think?
Well, does anybody have services inside of their home?
Well, not very many people, but...
Yeah, that was a confusing question. I almost skipped it.
But what do you think is going to happen? Given that it's...
If you exaggerate the number, you'll increase it. It depends also if you're going to put your name on this or if it's completely...
But my guess is you'll exaggerate it in the sense that if you're not religious at all, you'll just say zero and not care. But you can't go less than zero. You can't exaggerate.
Do you think those one and two will correlate at that point?
Obviously they're going to correlate, sure. I'd be surprised if they weren't. But what I was going to say is that the people for whom the number... is at all significant are people who think of themselves as religious. And if you think of yourself as religious, then you're likely to want to bias, even in your own memory, quite aside from other people, to say, well, yeah, of course, like, you know, maybe I missed once or twice, but kind of thing. What was your last year's income?
$400.
That'd be one question, yeah. Especially this time of year.
Well, you only have, you know, 5 more days.
Yeah. My proposal for reducing the size of government, by the way, is to move Election Day to April 16th.
Is that net or gross? Or?
Don't know. Doesn't say. What problems would you imagine with that one?
Fiscal year...
Those are all ambiguities. Are there any ways in which you'd expect a bias? Are there any ways in which you'd expect it to be consistently high or low? I mean, I agree, the question could be put much more clearly. Yeah, you would think it would probably depend on the people. But certainly many people will say, the richer I am, the more successful I am, I like to feel successful. You could imagine in the other direction, people who sort of say, well, you know, rich people are bad, poor people are virtuous. Yeah, I made some money last year, but, you know, let's minimize it so that I won't feel as though I ought to be giving more or helping more or something of that sort. How much did you contribute last year to organized religion? Again, what do you think?
Contribute? I would say all of it.
You contributed all your income to organized religion?
Pretty much.
I think it depends on what you put for how religious you are. That might, how many times you go to church, that might influence what that number is.
It surely would. Would you, in fact, get an accurate number, do you think?
Probably not.
Because?
Like, depending on, you know, what their particular reasons for, they might inflate or deflate.
I'm not sure anybody would deflate it in the sense that the people who don't want to be thought of as giving money to organized religion also don't give money to organized religion, right? So the people who would be giving the money would be religious people, and since they think of donation as a virtuous act, you would expect at least...
Some people don't want other people to know they donate. They do it anonymously, so they do not want to...
Sure. Let me see. Is there a name on this questionnaire?
Backwards,
yeah, well, actually, that's interesting, but it's being emailed, which means that they are going to know, if they want to, what the answers are. This is entirely irrelevant to this, but I'll tell you about it anyway because it's a good story, which is relevant to a different course I've taught. There was a very controversial case at Cornell a good many years ago in which some Cornell undergraduates had been emailing among themselves a list of misogynist jokes, so they have jokes making fun of women. And
how do you spell that word?
M-I-S-O-G-Y-N-I-S-T. Misogynist. G-Y-N is the same word as gynecology or polygyny. It had Greek for women. And somehow somebody outside the small group got a hold of it and sent it to a lot of other people. There was a whole lot of outrage about this evil sexist stuff. And the question was then raised of whether or not Cornell's rules had anything against people doing such things. And it was sort of a freedom of speech argument on the one side versus various things on the other. And the final outcome was that a Cornell official announced what they did was not in violation of any rules, so we aren't going to punish them, but they have voluntarily agreed to subject themselves to the following punishments. And one could interpret that as it's perfectly true, that they felt embarrassed and so forth, or one could interpret that as this is hypocrisy, that everybody knows that if they didn't voluntarily do this, they'd have a lot of trouble for the next 3 years at Cornell because the administration would be very mad at them, and therefore this is a way in which the Cornell administration can pretend to be in favor of freedom of speech while at the same time publishing people were saying politically incorrect things. There was a group of people at Cornell, I don't think we to this day know who they were, who took the second interpretation and ran with it. And so what they did was to write a bogus letter, an email, that claimed to be from the administrator who had made the public statement and which appeared to be a private email to the recipient, basically saying, you know, we feel that we've settled this matter very nicely, we have succeeded in punishing the three little pigs, or however many little pigs it was, while at the same time maintaining the pretense of freedom of speech. Let me know how you feel about it. And it was bogus, right? It was not, in fact, written by the person whose name was in the bottom. It was written by people who suspected Cornell of hypocrisy. It went out to a huge number of people, basically the whole Cornell population. They then collected the responses they got and published them. And, of course, the ones they published were mostly the responses saying, yay, I agree with this entirely. So they were using the, in one sense, anonymity of the email, the fact that, that people who received it didn't realize it wasn't coming from the person they claimed to be from, as a way of propagandizing for their interpretation of what had happened. And they were then selecting the responses and publishing them as a way of giving a biased sample, implying that that was what the Cornell community was in favor of. But it was sort of an interesting case of using the modern technology for propaganda in a fairly ingenious fashion. Anyway, if Harvard Law School employed a non-denominational chaplain, how likely is it that you would use his or her services?
Can you repeat the question one more?
Sure. Read it. You can read it. I don't want to talk. It's at the top. Suppose the question came first. How would it affect the answers to some of the others?
If this question was first?
If that were first, yeah.
You'd probably have them go to one side or the other.
That is, it would imply that one of the reasons for putting out the questionnaire was to decide whether to have a chaplain. So therefore, people who wanted a chaplain would tend to claim to be more religious than they were to get arguments for it. People who didn't want less religious, right?
And the answer would be more extreme.
That's my guess, yeah. And finally, number six. What?
That
sure is. All right. It's a nice example of how you bias things. All right. Take the number two. Suppose we put in a survey, what's the last digit of your telephone number? What would the histogram, remember that's the graph showing frequency of each number, look like? The special challenge question we aren't going to do now. How would you answer? How would you go about answering it, though?
Typically below the speed limit. Not only were they below the speed limit, they would clog up the middle lane so you couldn't pass in case someone was above the speed limit or at the speed limit in that case. So it was interesting to actually hear the question to take it to go below the speed limit. Because
no, this isn't below. This is 2% who are going the fastest.
Oh, okay.
So the question here is, I guess you could pick a ticket if somebody was going too slowly, at least on some roads there's a minimum speed, I think. But so the question is, how would you figure out the answer to this question? What?
Count out two standard deviations from.
Why count out two standard deviations? Why would that give you 2%?
A little bit more. Yeah,
because 2 would be 95, right? Is normal?
2 would be 95.
You'd have to look it up. But where do you look it up to get the answer? The Z table. That's what the Z table is telling you, is how many standard deviations out you need to get any given number of any given percentage. So you would do is you look on your Z table and you see how many, how big a Z do I need such that 2% will be above that. That's the number of standard deviation. Multiply it by 10 miles per hour, because that's what standard deviation is. Add it to 68, and you've got the answer to the question. All right, did people see that? Yes, no? No. Yes. What?
I mean, it'd be easier if you... Okay, so you just explain how it
works. Sure, let me run through.
I don't have the table here in front of me, but... The Z table is going to show a bunch of ranges of subnumbers of Zs. Probably it actually show 3.6 to give you another decimal place by using a bunch of separate columns would be the simplification. And it then says something like, I don't remember exactly how it's put, but it would be something like, say, 0.98.
Yes, percentages, right? So,
point. I'd have to look at the table to see how they express it. The one plausible way of expressing it is how much of the population would be below this. Mm. And if that's right, if this happened to be the number, you'd say, ha, 98% is below Z equal 3. So therefore, Z equal 3 is what will result in particularly 2% of the people, right? So Z equals 3 is 3 standard deviations, 10 miles an hour is standard deviations, so that's 30 miles per hour. But we're talking about deviations from the mean, and the mean is 68, so you add 68 to that. And that would tell you that if they ticketed everybody going 98 miles an hour, that would get the top 2%.
Well, you're also, the assumption is you're observing everybody. The cops are observing everybody.
You can
observe every driver.
You can observe every driver going faster than 98 miles an hour pretty well.
Well, not necessarily.
But yes, no, you're perfectly right. You would have to have some idea of how good their surveying was to know that. But it does say that 2% who are going the fastest, and if they can't observe everybody, there's no way they can take up the 2% who are going the fastest. The question isn't answerable.
Oh, yeah, there's only 2% off the top.
But it wouldn't be the 2% going the fastest.
That's the number of people that they can stop, right?
So I would take it that they mean of those they stop, of those they look at, or if they can survey all. But the real point is though, just seeing how you would use the Z table.
I like when you do the
All right, let's go on to hypothesis testing, the other thing you're doing, as opposed to estimating distributions. And the basic logic, you've presumably all heard phrases about something being statistically significant or statistically significant at the 0.05 level or things like that, at least if you read people's summaries of studies and things, they give that kind of result. And the basic logic of how you do this is that you have something called a null hypothesis, and the null hypothesis is what if nothing's wrong, so to speak. So if you think about coin flipping, your null hypothesis is a fair coin. You have 50% heads, 50% tails. And then you have an experiment. You flip the coin 10 times and it came up 7 heads. And the question is, how good a reason is that for you to reject the null hypothesis? For you to say, aha, this is a biased coin.
That's a tough question.
And
I'm sure we analyze it.
Yeah, that's what the statistics is in fact about. Implicit when you're doing that is some alternative to the null hypothesis. So that if the alternative were it's a two-headed coin, then if we said either it's a fair coin or it's two-headed, then it's easy. The first time it comes up tails, we can reject. We know that the null hypothesis is right. But suppose your null hypothesis is that the coin comes up heads more than average, but you don't know how much more than average. We would then say anything above 5 heads is evidence for that hypothesis. And the question then is how strong evidence is it for the hypothesis? And the way in which it's normally done is that you say, if the null hypothesis is true, if the coin is fair, how likely is it that we would get at least this many heads? And if you say as well, if the coin is fair, there's a 25% chance we get this many heads, well, then it's not very strong evidence it's not a fair coin, because, you know, 1 in 4 chances happen all the time. If you say if the coin is fair, there's 1 chance in 1,000 we get this many heads, you now have a pretty strong argument for suspecting that it's not a fair coin. So if you look at the bit at the end, if your calculation is that if the coin is fair, there's only a 5% chance that you would be this far from 50-50 on the coin flips, then you would say that the null hypothesis has been rejected at the 0.05 level. That's the way the language of statistical results is put. And for reasons I'll try to explain, it's a somewhat misleading language, which is part of what I want to go into. Does it mean that the chance that that it's a fair coin is less than 5%? If you think it does, let me offer you a very simple experiment. I'm not going to actually do it, but I will describe an imaginary experiment. My null hypothesis is that this is a fair coin. My alternative hypothesis in this case, just to make life easy, is it's a double-headed coin. And I'm not going to cheat by looking at the other side of it. And I flip it twice, and it comes up heads both times. But I flip it once, it comes up heads. If it's a fair coin, what's the probability that it'll come up heads when I flip it once? Does that mean that when it came up heads, we now know the chance that it's a fair coin is only 50%? In fact, as I've actually described the experiment, after I flip it once and it comes up heads, what do you think the odds are that it's a fair coin as opposed to a double-headed coin? Just your opinion.
Fair coin. Odds 95.8.
Much higher than that, right. Very, very high odds. Even if it comes up heads 2 or 3 times, you're still. And the reason is that you know that double-headed coins are very uncommon. It's quite unlikely I would reach them, you know, whereas at least roughly fair coins are very common. So that the 0.05 is not the probability that the null hypothesis is true given that we got 7 heads or whatever. It's the probability of getting at least 7 heads given that the null hypothesis is true. If we start out thinking the null hypothesis is much more likely than the alternative, then it's more likely that a likely event plus a somewhat unlikely event occurred than that a very unlikely event occurred. If you imagine, suppose I say 1 coin in 1,000 is double-headed, which is still too high. The chance that I picked a fair coin and it then came up 8 heads is almost certainty of picking a fair coin times, let us say, 1 chance in 20 that a fair coin would come up 8 heads. So the combined probability is about 1 in 20 of my first picking a fair coin and then getting 8 out of 10 heads. The probability of my picking a double-headed coin is 1 in 1,000. If I do, I'll get 8 heads with no trouble. But 1 in 1,000 times certainty is only 1 in 1,000. So in figuring out how likely your hypothesis, the alternatives are when you're finished, you need an initial estimate of how likely they are, what's called a prior probability. All right. So as I say, I went through it there. I'm just trying to make that point. So the more heads I get, the more likely it becomes it's double-headed. But that may mean that it goes from 1 in 1,000 to 1 in 100, not that it goes from 1 in 1,000 to 95 in 100. Yes, the second point is the statistical significance is not a statement of importance, it's a statement of how sure you are that there's something there. So imagine that I actually took a random coin and flipped it 10,000 times. How likely do you think it is that I will be able to show to at least a 0.05 level that it's not a fair coin? 10,000 flips. What's your best guess of what happens if you pick a coin and flip it 10,000 times? Do you get 5,000 heads and 5,000 tails?
Not exactly, but probably pretty close.
And suppose you got 5,050 of one and 5,000 minus 50 the other. If we did another 10,000 flips, what do you think would happen?
similar, possibly
deviation will go down.
The deviation for the combined effect would go down, but I would predict the deviation will be in the same direction, because I don't believe this is a fair coin. I don't believe there are any fair coins. I believe what we usually call a fair coin is a coin where the probability of heads is somewhere between 0.49 and 0.51, roughly, that the coin is not perfectly symmetrical. And with even a very, very small deviation from fair, if you flip it enough times, you're going to get a result that you wouldn't expect from a fair coin. Yeah.
There's probably more involved in
what?
Flipping of the coin. I actually read an interesting article about this, that the people who flip it may not actually flip, it may twirl or something like that. So how you flip it determines.
That
so
might also.
If you have the coin that's heads up, there is a slight edge toward it. We're meaning heads as it comes down.
Could well be, but you'd have.
Very, very tiny.
Yes. Flip. Sure. The characteristics of the coin aren't the only relevant variable. The point I'm making is that if you have a really big sample, you can detect even very small deviations from fairness. A small deviation from fairness probably isn't important, and yet you're very sure it's there. So that statistical significance is how sure you are it's there, not how big it is. On the other hand, suppose it's a die, and suppose that in fact the die has the numbers 4, 5, and 6 on it, twice each. I roll it a couple of times. I get an average result of 5. That's way off what the average ought to be for a real die. But I'm not expecting it. That's cheating. But in fact, I'm not at all confident that it's not a fair die. Because I only rolled it 2 or 3 or 4 times. It wouldn't be surprising to get that high of average even with a fair die. It's not what you expect, but it's not. If I roll it 100 times to get a high one, I get very confident. So my point is only that you have to distinguish in any statistical result between the size of the result and the confidence of the result. And what statisticians refer to as significance is your confidence, not your size. All right, so suppose the question is, let's go back to, I think, a hypothetical example last time. Suppose we're using statistics to discover who's the best property professor here. And we say, all right, let's look for the last many years of students who took property from Professor A or Professor B, how many of them passed the bar or pay or. Does the bar have a separate section on property that you get separate scores on? Anybody know?
No, they're all
mixed. What?
They're all mixed together.
They're all mixed together, so you count. It might be, if you didn't have very many students, it might be that one professor was much better than the other. And yet you had no significant result. Because you would say, yes, one of the students, we have 20 students from each professor, and 14 from one passed the bar and 19 from the other. That's a big difference. But with 20 students, that's the kind of difference you could get by random chance. So that would be a case where the effect is large, but the statistical significance is small. Flip it around, if you had 10,000 students by each, it might be that one of them, 16% of the students passed the bar, and the other 16.1% of the students passed the bar. So it's a tiny effect, but if you had lots and lots of students, you could be very sure it was there. So that's the difference between the size of an effect and the statistical significance of the effect. And since it's a difference that frequently gets blurred when people are talking, if someone says, yes, indeed, you know, mercury causes birth defects, and we've proved it at the 0.05 level. And the question is what you have proved at the 0.05 level that mercury in, or whatever, is it mercury? There's something or other, which, probably not mercury, there's been some controversy about vaccinations or something causing autism, is it? That's right. Mercury and, somehow I thought mercury had something to do with it, but anyway, the vaccinations causing autism. And it makes a big difference whether what you're saying is there's a 0.05 chance that there's some relation, or whether you're saying there's a substantial relation. Because it might be that because you've got millions of people to look at, the result you found is people who were vaccinated had a 0.009 chance of getting it, and people who weren't vaccinated had a 0.00899 chance of almost exactly the same number, and yet it could be quite significant statistically speaking.
So in that case, you're saying that if you had enough people, you'd be confident that that actually was a real difference?
That there was a real difference, but it could be a tiny difference.
Right.
And in the other direction, it could be the difference was quite large.
But it doesn't matter. It's not necessarily true. You're not confident in the result because it's a small sample.
That's right. Exactly. And it just makes the point that it's important to distinguish those two things because they sound like they're the same thing. So, you know, how significant is it? Let's go on to a point that's relevant to this. Any guesses what the odds are? Any of you play bridge? What are the odds that when we deal out the cards, one player has all spades, one all hearts, and so forth? I'm not asking for an actual number, although you might be able
to. Very, very small.
Very, 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 very small. So if it happened, what would be your conclusion? Obviously somebody's rigged the deck for a joke.
Yeah.
Right? How about some other deal? Consider whatever deal you got the last time you played bridge. How likely was that?
Did that one happen? It'd be as likely as having all spades.
That's right. That any particular deal is phenomenally unlikely.
That's why you play duplicate. You couldn't read at the chance that play duplicate bridge.
Well, you could if you played enough hands.
Yeah, you played enough hands, but nobody's got that.
Yep. But so why is it? If the deal you actually got was just as unlikely as 13 spades, 13 hearts, etc., why is it that if you got 13 spades, 13 hearts, you would include something you'd rigged the deck and not with the actual deal you got?
One's particularly important because if you just claim you've been maximum whatever you're going to win.
Well, that's not what happens, obviously. What happens is people say, all right, I don't believe this. Wait a minute. No, what happened is you bid seven spades and your opponent bid seven no trump.
Yeah.
And you double.
Yeah, exactly. It's fine.
For any bridge players, it's a somewhat bizarre situation.
I've never had anything like that, so yes.
But a different way of putting it is that it's not that your ordinary deal is more likely with a real with a shuffled deck. It's the 13 spades is more likely with a rigged deck. That what's striking about that one, out of all the unlikely ones, is that it's the unlikely one that somebody who was trying to play a joke would do. And therefore, when it happens, the odds that somebody playing a joke rather than just one more deal become much higher. If you look at why don't you just read through it, because I don't want to push my voice, but the last one, the flip it 100 times. So the question you're asking is really not how likely is this particular outcome, but how likely is this outcome or some other outcome that would be seen as a strong evidence against the null hypothesis. Because each outcome is unlikely, then the fact that one of many unlikely outcomes happen doesn't tell you that the null hypothesis is false. Right? You say, given the null hypothesis of their coin, if we flip it 100 times, it's quite unlikely to be 50-50. So that's unlikely, too. So is 51-49s. But we say, rather, if it came up 55-45, how likely is it that it would be that far off or farther off? That those are all the cases we would take as evidence against the null hypothesis. So everything is unlikely. This is very useful if you want to be a con man. So suppose you want to start an investment newsletter and make a fortune. All right. Read my description. Is it clear why you're going to make a fortune? Right. You've called it right 3 times in a row. So clearly they should be willing to pay you for a year's subscription to your newsletter. For the next year, you do nothing that's very risky, and so you keep some of them. All right. So, does anybody see what's going on with my Diet Coke example? The trick is that when you started your experiment, you didn't know it was Diet Coke you were looking for. When you started an experiment, what you're asking is, can I find evidence that some foodstuff causes cancer? And there are, let us say, 300 different foodstuffs you're looking at. You look at Diet Coke, regular Coke, Pepsi, potato chips, whatever you like. So if you look at 300 different foodstuffs in each case, looking to see whether its correlation with getting cancer is higher than average, is it surprising that for some of them you get a 1 in 20 result? No, if you look at 300, you ought to get considerably more than 1 in 20, right? Just like if you flip your coin, if you did your 100 flips 1,000 times, you'd get some very unlikely results. So what's called a specification search in statistics consists of you have some result, some prediction, and you think of a whole lot of ways, different ways of setting up the statistical test and try all of them. And when one of them works, you report that. And you say, well, there's only one chance in 20 that by chance I would have gotten this good a result. But you did 40 experiments, and you only reported the best one, so it's not surprising that one of them in 20 by chance did it. So that's, well, we're running out of time now, so I'll discuss a little bit of this next time. And I'm running out of voice as well.